It is the spookiest of seasons, which means scary movies are on everyone's watch list. But have you ever wanted to be inside of one of the most chilling films ever made? Buffalo Bill's House, the real home where Silence of the Lambs, winner of 5 Academy Awards, was filmed, is now open to the public for overnight stays, guided tours, special events, and even available for on-location filming and photo shoots. Buffalo Bill's House is the epitome of an experiential location. The most recent addition to the house is the interactive well set located in the basement of the house, fully open for guests to enjoy. The well is a replica of the infamous well in the movie. Brave guests can actually enter the 4-foot-deep well for gruesome photo ops. The well is constructed of real granite with all of the gruesome markings from the movie, including bloody fingernail scratches along the wall. The well itself was built in partnership with the legendary special effects makeup artist and lifelong Pittsburgh resident, Tom Savini. This incredible set comes complete with lotion basket and hose for those who refuse to place the lotion on the skin, all while Precious looks on. The other main attraction is Buffalo Bill's Workshop of Horrors, a carefully recreated Buffalo Bill's dance set from the film, complete with vintage Singer sewing machine, disco ball, 4 female mannequins, and a Buffalo Bill-style kimono for guest use to get their tuck on. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast have been to this great place and loved reenacting all of these memorable scenes in addition to so many more. It's one thing to watch this classic film, but a whole other thing to live out those same scenes with full props and costumes. This awesome location isn't just a museum of film history, but a place to live out that history in fun and exciting ways. All of that is in addition to an incredible tour that allows you to retrace the footsteps of Agent Clarice Starling and serial killer Buffalo Bill and their climactic cat and mouse game in the closing moments of Silence of the Lambs. The tours are personally conducted by Buffalo Bill's house owner Chris Rowan, who is a fountain of Silence of the Lambs movie knowledge and a professional set designer. He has the insider info on making of these movie sets. During the exclusive tours, intimate groups of guests are guided through the home on tours that last approximately 90 minutes. If you want to relive one of the most memorable and terrifying moments in movie history, check out BuffaloBillsHouse.com on the internet, at BuffBillsHouse on Twitter or X, and at BuffaloBillsHouse on Instagram for all of the information to tuck away, or else you'll get the hose again. It's the story of the crew experiencing what to them is a crazy event, things they cannot fathom or understand, says Andre Overdahl, director of The Last Voyage of the Demeter. In the pantheon of Dracula movies, he adds, that is a very unique and interesting take, to twist it around completely where nobody knows who Dracula is. He is just the enemy. He is just the alien. We get to know these crew members from various parts of the world who just happened to be gathered on this specific ship. And obviously, horror ensues. Hello everyone and welcome back to a very special Halloween boatcast from the Victorian schooner that is the Golden Silent Films podcast. Now this is a non-canon episode we decided to make as a logical part 2 to our earlier Last Voyage of the Impusa episode and final entry in the Boats of Dracula series. Now, we thought since this movie actually inspired that episode, it only seemed fair to kind of go a little out of our comfort zone and talk about this movie. Now, if you aren't into sound and dialogue and you want to skip this episode, that is perfectly fine and okay with us. And we will be back to non-spooky silent duty with our next episode. If you're a new listener here and want to learn about The Last Voyage of the Demeter, welcome, and we would love to have you stay and experience the magic of silent film. Before we fight the oncoming plague that is vampires, let's give the usual Golden Silent Films podcast spooky social media roundup. As per usual, please creep on over to Golden Silence Cast on Instagram for up-to-date info on this little podcast. And for all of you vampire fanatics out there on Twitter or X or whatever it may be at the time of this episode, just follow at Golden Silence One or just search Golden Silence Cast and we ought to pop up. All these screen names and sites will be in the episode description in case you are interested in digging us up. We would love to have you on board the ship. At both social spaces, you'll get behind the scenes pics and info, upcoming episode reveals and other fun film-related materials. And also great photos of our hopefully non-bloodthirsty podcasts, Gizmo and Soda Pop. Also, if you're listening to this program on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, do leave a review, a rating, or both. All of those ratings and reviews help immensely. You've got opinions and we want to hear them. Live your best review leaving afterlife and help our little show grow and reach fellow silent film fans. Whether getting us more exposure in the podcast world or letting us know how we can improve, we appreciate the feedback and always want to bring you the best show possible. And do subscribe to the Golden Silent Films podcast. Whilst our output can be sketchy, if you are subscribed, you will never miss an episode, and the moment new content drops, it will download straight to your listening device of choice. Now, we are nearing the end of our third season and don't want you to miss a scary second of insidious infotainment. So, this is a very special and rare occasion where we are discussing a recent first-run theatrical film. Some of the magic of this show as creators is that we never quite know what exactly is going on from one episode to the next. And the thought that a first-run movie would make it onto the show is something we could never have predicted. Even if this is just a non-canon episode, it's still wild to be talking about sound pictures. Now that being said, much of our observations and impressions of this film come straight from our local movie theater experience. It was really cool to talk about a film from the theater perspective. Films we cover here are on YouTube, on DVD, Blu-ray, watching them on a television, but there is definitely a magic to seeing a movie on the biggest of screens. And adding to the experience was one of the best buckets of popcorn I have ever had. Now, since we waited to put this episode out in the midst of prime Halloween scariness, we lucked out and also got to experience the film via Blu-ray as well. The Blu-ray has gorgeous visuals on a 4K television and a pretty solid lineup of special features. It has a number of behind-the-scenes featurettes and a commentary track with director Andre Overdahl and producer Bradley J. Fisher. By the time this episode comes out and you are listening to it, The Last Voyage of the Demeter is streaming as well as on home video. If you miss it in the theaters or at home, pause the podcast, come back for more murderous boat ride fun, and we will not think twice about it. This movie is totally worth it, and we're not even going to be mad. Now, as of recording, I'm up to 6 viewings of this film. I saw it twice in theaters and now 4 times at home on Blu-ray. And I will definitely keep watching this and put it into regular scary rotation. That speaks, I think, to the quality of this movie and a fun dive into a little-known bit of literary history. In 1922's Nosferatu, the story of the movie's life post-premiere was incredibly wild. The fact that it even exists is a miracle. If you don't know all the details, all the ins and outs, we have an episode all about it called Stoker vs. Nosferatu. It's a really fun episode with a boatload of legal wrangling and copyright shenanigans. Now, all that is to say this film, Last Voyage of the Demeter, has its own wild story, except the drama here comes from the long journey to get the movie made. The story of how this movie made it to your local cinema is just as fascinating as the on-screen boat journey, but with less blood. There are twists and turns in this tale that, oddly enough, start with the Francis Ford Coppola-directed 1992 film Bram Stoker's Dracula. This film's concept and original script was written by Bragi Shoot. In an interview with the website bloodyflicks.co.uk, Shoot explains the germ of an idea and how it settled itself on the high seas. Bragi says, "I originally wanted to write a horror film set in space. I'm a huge fan of Alien and Aliens, and I wanted to try something in that same genre. But no matter what I came up with, everything just felt like an Alien ripoff. So I shelved my plans. Anyway, when I first arrived in Hollywood, I managed to get a job working in a model shop. I became friendly with the model makers, and one of the guys had his portfolio, and he showed it to me. He had all these wonderful miniatures in it, things from Total Recall and Edward Scissorhands and a bunch of other movies. And there were these photos of this fantastic schooner with bloody tattered sails. Well, they caught my eye, and I asked him what they were from, and he replied, 'That's the Demeter. That's the ship that carried Dracula from Transylvania to London. It was used for a few shots in Coppola's Dracula movie.' And it hit me. That was my way into this alien-type story. But instead of setting it in the future in space, I would set it in the past, on a boat. I think it's really wild that this movie was born out of another fantastic Dracula film, albeit incredibly weird how a movie that really no-sold the whole sea voyage bit inspired a great horror flick on board the Demeter. When Shoot initially had the idea, he wanted to make his idea work within the constraints of the original novel. Braggy Shoot would explain this process with the Bloody Flicks website. Shoot explained, "I tried to construct a story so that I wouldn't violate what was in the book. There are these journal entries told from the perspective of the captain, and I wanted to try and preserve those. But in expanding one tiny chapter into an entire movie, I also knew that I had to expand and invent a bunch of new material. So it was a tricky balancing act. There are a few cheats, elements I added that are not in the book, but in general, I think it's very much true to the spirit of the book, and the differences can be explained in ways that don't violate the journal entries that people know from the book. As is the case with many a script in Hollywood, it would find itself mired in production hell. The story of The Last Voyage of the Demeter's trip would wind its way through studio to studio, and director to director, and eventually writer to writer. So let's break down the complicated road that The Last Voyage took and see why it took over 20 years to finally reach cinemas. With Shoot's script out in the entertainment ether, Phoenix Pictures acquired the rights in 2003 and brought on Robert Schwenke to direct and rewrite the script with Mitch Bryan. What started strong would eventually bog down until December of 06, when James V. Hart, screenwriter of Bram Stoker's Dracula, turned in a new draft of the script. By May of 2009, time ran out for Schwenke, and Marcus Nispel would step up as his replacement. The production was slated to begin that year. However, it would be production complications, like adapting the period setting and filming on the water, that would cause Nispel to depart. By March of 2010, the studio pushed forward once again with Stefan Ruzowitzki directing, with Mike Medavoy, Arnold W. Messer, and Bradley J. Fisher slated to produce. After generating some early buzz, Fisher sought out a meeting with Noomi Rapace in August of 2010 to discuss work on the film. Fisher performed his own revisions to the script and officially cast Rapace and Ben Kingsley in October of that year. Like twice before, though, a director would leave the project, with Ruzowitzki exiting the film in favor of taking on another project. As the directing carousel continued to turn, director David Slade would be attached briefly before Rapace dropped out. Not long after, Jude Law was reportedly in line to lead the film. The next month, Slade reassured folks that the film was still moving forward, despite appearances to the contrary. In May of 2012, Neil Marshall and Millennium Films took the lead to direct and produce, respectively. On the writing side, novelist Lowell Caulfield was brought on for further rewrites. By June, more changes were in store. Now Viggo Mortensen began talks to portray the lead role, with Kingsley still said to be attached. By December of 2014, Marshall was still hopeful that the film would be made. That positivity only lasted so long before Marshall was gone, too. There seemed to be a light at the end of the tunnel in October of 2019, when it was announced that Andre Overdahl would direct the film, with Amblin Partners obtaining the rights. The horror fans out there may recognize the name. Overdahl has directed such acclaimed films as Trollhunter, The Autopsy of Jane Doe, and most recently, a film I especially loved, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. In an interview with Rue Morgue, Overdahl explains how he came aboard the cinematic ship. Overdahl says, "One of the producers, Brad Fisher, is also a producer on The Long Walk. We were working together on that, and they were looking for a director for Demeter, and I loved the script. So I pitched my take on it to them and Amblin, and it seemed to work." With those pieces in place, casting actually started in earnest. In January of 2021, Corey Hawkins joined the cast of the film with a new draft written by Zach Olkovich. In December of 2022, Shute and Olkovich received screenplay credit, with Shute receiving screen story credit, with others receiving off-screen additional literary material credits. In that interview with bloodyflicks.co.uk, Shute made it clear the toll that it took on him. I mean, to see something you created go through so many starts and stops has to be tough on anyone. As Braggy Shute explains, "I would see the name of my script pop up on these annual lists every so often of the so-called most famous unproduced scripts, and it was just painful. Over the years, all the people, so many talented people who tried to get this made, it boggles the mind. Marcus Nispel, and David Slade, and Robert Schwenke, and Neil Marshall, the list goes on and on. Anyway, when I heard that Amblin was taking a swing at it, all my walls came up and I told myself, don't get excited, it's going to fall apart again. Somehow, it's not going to happen. And then, somehow, suddenly, Andre was in Malta and sending me photos of the ship being built, and I had to pinch myself, and it finally happened 20 years later. And to add insult to injury, once the script was out in the wild, Shute was pretty much a bystander at that point, his creation now in the hands of other folks. But eventually he was out of the circle. This can be a rough spot to put in for anyone. In an interview with the screenwriting website writetoreal.com, Shute explains his position by the time Overdahl was at the helm. Shute explains, "I did a lot of rewrites on that project, a lot, in caps. But at this point, no, I'm no longer involved. The director, Andre Overdahl, has graciously kept me in the loop with occasional update and casting news and set builds and stuff, but no, in general, I'm not involved. Which is probably for the best. I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into that script, and I'm not sure at this moment I have the fortitude to face it again." So now, the movie is set to go, and cameras are ready to roll. Before we get into the particulars, let's go back to that cast and learn a little more and find out who will be involved in the battle on the boat. No vampire movie experience is complete without a violent, blood-sucking monstrosity. Over the years, the role of Dracula or Nosferatu has been one of the most coveted roles in filmdom. Not only is the role great in and of itself, but playing Transylvania's most famous resident has built or enhanced some of the biggest careers in Hollywood. In the early days, you had Max Schreck and Bela Lugosi leading the way, to be followed by the great Christopher Lee in the horror Hammer films. The year 1992 would see Dracula incarnations in two disparate productions, Gary Oldman in Bram Stoker's Dracula and Leslie Nielsen in the awesome Dracula Dead and Loving It. Even the stars of today, like Gerard Butler, Luke Evans, and most recently Nicolas Cage, have taken up the fang-filled mantle on the big screen. That brings us to the newest member of the club, the ghoulish master of monsters portraying the feral Dracula in Last Voyage of the Demeter, Javier Botet. The backstory of Botet is a really fascinating one, a real voyage that starts in Spain and ends up in the horrors of Hollywood. Javier Botet Lopez was born on July 30th, 1977, in Ciudad Real, Spain. As a youngster, age 5 to be exact, he was diagnosed with Marfan syndrome, a disorder that would eventually lead the young man to the movies. Now, if you're like me and had no idea what the disorder is, here's a general description. Marfan syndrome is a multisystemic genetic disorder that affects the connective tissue. Folks with this disorder tend to be tall and thin, with long arms, legs, fingers, and toes. They also typically have exceptionally flexible joints and abnormally curved spines. The severity of symptoms can differ from person to person, though. Many people with Marfans enjoy normal life expectancy with proper treatment. You may have heard of another famous actor with Marfan syndrome. That would be Peter Mayhew of Chewbacca and Star Wars fame. Botet would tell Entertainment Weekly's Clark Collis, "Marfan syndrome is a connective tissue disorder. It makes you so flexible in the joints, very long. In childhood, you grow so fast if you have Marfan. The doctor told my father, 'Your child will probably never get 20 years. I was so lucky because medicine has changed so much. Now the expectancies of Marfan life, it's so big. It's like 75 or even more. But yes, I need to take care, be responsible, and go to the doctor yearly.'" Rebecca Ford, in an article for The Hollywood Reporter, talks about the early film career of Botet. Ford writes, "So after studying fine arts in Granada, Botet moved to Madrid, where he still lives, got a job as a book illustrator, and in his free time began making short films of himself with his own camera. Later, he enrolled in a movie makeup class, hoping the teacher would introduce him to directors. The plan worked. At 27, he landed his first monster role in Brian Usna's 2005 horror film, Beneath Still Waters. Botet's unique physical traits coupled with an interest in the performing arts made for a memorable first outing on screen as well. 2 years later, he played the role of Tristiana Maderos in Juame Baiguero and Paco Plaza's 2000 film Wreck. He would also follow that up with Wreck 2. You could say that the 6'7" tall Botet was born to play the kind of elongated or otherwise outsized creatures that pepper the filmographies of Juan, Overdahl, and Del Toro, the latter of whom cast him as multiple ghosts in Crimson Peaks, writes Clark Collis. Now that is really a murderer's row of directors, but let's rewind a bit and let's talk about another director instrumental in the career of Javier Botet. Clark Collis writes, "Botet's biggest break came when he attended Austin's Fantastic Fest in 2009 to promote Wreck 2 and encountered Argentinian filmmaker Andy Muschietti, who was screening his horror short Mama. Muschietti went on to cast Botet in the title role of a vengeful ghost in the hit feature film version of the concept, which was produced by Del Toro and shot in Toronto. Speaking of Guillermo del Toro, the visionary director would end up casting Boutet as three different ghosts in his 2015 film Crimson Peak. He later portrayed a spectral figure in Leonardo DiCaprio's Nightmare in the Revenant, although that scene ended up cut from the final release. He also lent his ghastly gifts to the role of Crooked Man in James Wan's The Conjuring 2. James Wan was definitely a cheerleader for Boutet and his talents. He really did bring something special to the second Conjuring film. Wan would say, "Javier is such a talented performer who brings a lot of personality to his characters. People are constantly mistaking his physical performance in The Conjuring 2 as stop motion or computer generated. Despite the creepy, scary characters he portrays, he's the sweetest guy to work with." Boutet has also appeared in theater roles and television roles. In 2010, he portrayed Frankenstein's monster in Teatro del Canale's stage adaptation of Frankenstein. So, Dracula is not his first dip into the world of legendary monsters. On television, Boutet appeared in a 2019 episode of Star Trek Discovery, where he appeared as a member of an alien species known as the Ba'ul. Also in 2019, Boutet appeared in an episode of Game of Thrones. "When I've been through a few days with hard makeup, sometimes I'm tired and I think, I've got to stop," he tells The Hollywood Reporter. "But then I see in the monitor this monster appearing. It's beautiful, and I think, yes, I am that creature." Since it's not a Dracula film without a great vampire, it's also incomplete without a great vampire hunter. And we get that for sure in the late crew addition of Clemens to the future death ship Demeter. So, with that in mind, let's dive into the life of Corey Hawkins, who was born in Washington, D.C. on October 22, 1988. He is definitely a man trained for the theatrical life. He attended the Duke Ellington School of the Arts and graduated from the Juilliard School in New York City. During his tenure at Juilliard, Hawkins received the prestigious John Houseman Award for Excellence in Classical Theater. After graduating, he got right to work. There was no time wasted. He started his career in off-Broadway shows and guest spots on television. One of his earliest cinematic gigs was a small bit part in Iron Man 3, followed by the Liam Neeson thriller Nonstop. By 2014, things really got cooking for Hawkins. In addition to Nonstop, he starred as Tybalt in a Broadway production of Romeo and Juliet. In 2015, he starred as Dr. Dre in Straight Outta Compton, followed by a role in Kong Skull Island in 2017. Hawkins also starred in 2018's Black Klansman. In a film career that only started in 2011, he already has been in 15 films. Lest you think he is a movie-only kind of talent, I will have you think again. In addition to his film work, Hawkins was involved in some of the biggest television shows around. He spent two seasons playing Heath in AMC's The Walking Dead and the lead role of Eric Carter in 24, Legacy. Leading up to Last Voyage, Hawkins had roles in 2019's Six Underground and In the Heights. In 2021, he flexed his Shakespearean muscles again in The Tragedy of Macbeth. His acting career to this point has netted the man multiple shelves and mantles worth of awards and nominations. From NAACP Image Awards to SAG Awards to Tonys, the man has done it all. Unless you think he is a movie and television-only kind of talent, Hawkins even performed God Bless America for the men's single final at the U.S. Open. Hawkins is an actor unafraid to tackle new experiences. He sees the pushing of limits as something he needs to bring out the best in his performances. In an interview with Perry Niemiroff for Collider.com, Hawkins explains, "And so my thing is, I don't really want to do it unless it excites me, and it's a marathon and it's not a sprint. So yeah, I'm going to run to the things that scare me. I'm going to run and go play, go do a British accent. I mean, I know how it could be received if it isn't done well, but I also know, why do it if you're not stretching yourself? And I want to look back and just say, oh yeah, I've tackled that. I've tackled this, I've tackled these different things, and not because I'm picking these things. I'm going after what is different and what appeals to me." So, with that out of the way, since it's not a Dracula boat film without a great vampire and a great vampire hunter, it's also incomplete without a great first mate. In this instance, we get Wojciech aboard the doomed Demeter. The role of Wojciech is played by David Dastmalchian. Dastmalchian was born on July 21, 1975 in Allentown, Pennsylvania, to parents Priscilla and Hossein Dastmalchian. He was one of four children, having two sisters and a brother. His parents would eventually divorce, however. He wouldn't remain a Pennsylvania boy forever, though. He was raised in Overland Park, Kansas, where he attended Shawnee Mission South High School. While in high school, David joined the drama club. Growing up, he was a big fan of theater, football, and comic books, all things that would be part of his life to later on. In an interview with Christy Puchko from Mashable.com, Desmalkin talks about how he ended up in the show business. The actor explains, "I grew up in Kansas, and the path for me to get financial assistance to go to college was through athletics. I was decent enough at football, and I was getting opportunities to possibly play college football. Through the encouragement of teachers, I auditioned for a theater conservatory acting program in Chicago at DePaul University, the theater school. And I not only got accepted to the program, I was given a scholarship. So I moved to Chicago, and all of a sudden, my life changed." He would graduate from DePaul in 1999, but it was far from a smooth ride. While in school, he dealt with depression and addiction to heroin that nearly derailed his career before it even started. Turning back to Clark Collis again, in an article for Entertainment Weekly, he writes, "That life was not always been rosy for the actor who suffers from bouts of severe depression and began using drugs in high school to self-medicate. After graduating, Desmalkin moved to Chicago and enrolled in DePaul University's theater program, but succumbed to heroin addiction in the course of his studies and wound up homeless. He eventually entered a psychiatric facility, followed by rehab, and started working low-paid jobs while he took roles on the stage. Half a decade into his recovery, he got the chance to audition for Christopher Nolan's second Batman film, 2008's The Dark Knight, which was shooting in Chicago." Desmalkin began his professional career in the mid-2000s in Chicago, working on stage and in commercials. He received a lot of great press for lead roles in Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie and Sam Shepard's Barry Child at Chicago's Shattered Globe Theater. His feature film debut came in the aforementioned The Dark Knight as the Joker's deranged henchman, Thomas Schiff. Desmalkin explains, "In 2007, I was 5 years clean and sober. I was doing theater for free, basically, in Chicago and working as a telemarketer. I got the opportunity to audition for this film based upon one of my favorite characters of all time. One of the greatest filmmakers of all time, Christopher Nolan, looked at me and said, 'Yeah, you. Come be a part of this,'" Desmalkin continues. "My last day of filming The Dark Knight, I remember I walked past the alley where I used to sleep when I was homeless and struggling with my addiction. That experience, my very first time of being on the set of the movie, changed my life in every way you can possibly imagine." In March 2014, Desmalkin put his life experiences to the page and was awarded the Special Jury Prize for Courage and Storytelling at the South by Southwest Film Festival. He wrote and starred in the feature film Animals, directed by Colin Shifley. The film starred Desmalkin and Kim Shaw as a couple living in a broken-down car who scam strangers to support their heroin addiction. When their misadventures turn from bad to worse, the young lovers must decide if true love can prevail in the face of all else. This role was a breakout performance for Desmalkin. He has also appeared on television as Simon on the Fox sci-fi series Almost Human, as a chess expert and murder suspect on the CBI forensic procedural drama series CSI, and as Oz Turner in the BBC drama series Intruders. Other television appearances include the FX sitcom The League, the Showtime crime drama series Ray Donovan, and the NBC medical drama ER. Throughout his career, he has been a go-to actor for director Denis Villeneuve. He has had roles in 2013's Prisoners, 2017's Blade Runner 2049, and most recently in Dune from 2021, where he played Peter DeVries. The lifelong comic book lover would also return to roles that jumped off the page. On the Marvel side of things, he played Kurt in all three Ant-Man films. He further added to his comic book bona fides by also doing work on various DC projects. Desmalkin portrayed DC Comics villain Abracadabra in Season 3 and 7 of the television incarnation of The Flash. In 2021, he appeared as Polka Dot Man in The Suicide Squad. In addition to all of those Detective Comics-y live-action goodness, he also has lent his voice to many of their animated films. On top of acting in comic film properties, Desmalkin is also a comic book writer. He debuted his horror comic series Count Crowley in 2019. The comic was published by Dark Horse Comics. Every character is important. Every role is important, Dust Malkian says as he explains his space in the movie world. I know it's an old cliche, but I did learn that in Chicago theater when I was only getting to be, say, Montano in Othello. You know, you've got two scenes to try and actually help propel a story. As a character actor, as someone who's always looked up to the John Cazales and the Peter Lorres of cinema history, I want to be like a slingshot to the movies, you know what I mean? I want to be a guy that helps shoot things forward. So, with that biographical cargo stowed away, let's bon voyage our way across the ocean and shoot things forward as we head over to the movie breakdown. The film opens by telling us, in 1897, a Russian schooner was chartered to carry private cargo, consisting of 50 wooden crates from Romania to England. When the ship arrived, it was derelict. The name of the vessel was Demeter, and this is the story of its crew, based on the captain's log from the novel Dracula. The movie proper starts on August 6, 1897, a truly dark and stormy night. The merchant ship Demeter has washed ashore in Whitby, England. Police and town officials are among those searching the wreckage. One of the police officers finds the captain's log, and a tale of horror and bloodshed follows. It's an incredibly terrifying yet compelling travel blog of ye olden times. This log is a record and a warning, and if it finds you, God help you, as he has abandoned the Demeter. We tried to stop him. If we didn't succeed, God have mercy on your souls. Now, as filming commenced, writer Bragi's shoot was unfortunately a bit out of the loop. As we mentioned earlier, by the time filming commenced, the script had been through so many hands and production companies. Then, while seeing your baby produced from afar can be a bummer, director Andre Overdahl tried to make the situation as workable as possible. In his interview with bloodyflix.co.uk, Shute explains, "Regrettably, I was not on set for the shooting. I was on a new assignment and pretty busy at the time, and Andre was shooting the film in Germany and Malta, and I just didn't have the chance to get over there. But Andre was wonderful and kept me in the loop and sent me all of these fantastic photos from the shoot, which were a real treat to see. I am a huge fan of Andre's work and was thrilled when he signed on to make Demeter. I've been a fan of his since Trollhunter. I hope we get to collaborate on something else, and maybe this time I will be able to be there when they film it." Back in film action, we zip back to 4 weeks earlier with the Demeter making port in Varna, Bulgaria. There, the ship is picking up cargo for transport to London. The shipment, consisting of multiple large wooden crates, is transported by locals from Romania who refuse to help load it and wish the crew good luck. They say the cargo is cursed. This scene and the surrounding bits about loading up the boat really works great in setting up the boat lingo and backdrop we are about to cast off on. Key to any great boat film is attention to detail that really sells you on the voyage. This movie had two great ties to a legitimate, believable boat work. The first came early in the process with the writing of the script. Bragi's shoot explains it more in an interview with RightToReel.com. With Demeter, it was a lot of research about old boats, shoot says, and trying to figure out how sailors of that time might have talked in the language they used and making the world of the boat and the terms they used feel accurate. If you don't know a lot about boats and ships, and I actually do know some, you have a lot of research to do to make it feel real. Forget about port and starboard, that's the tip of the iceberg. There are so many names and terms for the different parts of a boat that even coming up with proper scene headers requires research. Back to the ship, we are introduced to Clemens, a doctor who overhears that the ship is looking for crew members. The Brit Mr. Clemens is played by the aforementioned Corey Hawkins. We are also introduced to Captain Elliot and his young son Toby. 6th of July. Made port in Varna, Bulgaria. Our crew was a few hands short, and I have tasked Mr. Wojciech to remedy this before we take on cargo. Clemens hears the Demeter is looking for crew for a mission to England. He attempts to convince Wojciech and the captain that he would be a valuable asset and crew member because of his medical skills and education in astronomy at Cambridge, but is initially rejected by First Mate Wojciech, played here by David Dust Malkian. While we're here, let's take a look at that second bit of backstory that adds some authenticity to the proceedings. In his interview with Mashable, David Dust Malkian talked about his real-life seafaring experience. I had always read in the backs of comic books these ads that would say, make $1,000 a week, be a fisherman in Alaska, work in a cannery in Alaska, he explained. And that was that. I took a Greyhound bus to Seattle, Washington, which is where I had heard all of the fishing companies were, and I just started going to the docks and going up to the guys of the boats and saying, how do I get a job here? Thus Malkin continues, just like being an actor, you get told no, and then no, no, no. And then eventually someone says, come on. I mean, I slept in a park and in a homeless shelter until I got on a boat. And then when I did, I stayed there for a long time, and I loved it. And I was able to make enough money to help me get back to school. It changed my life. It gave me a perspective on the world that I never could have gotten in any other experience. Now that experience totally adds to his performance. There were little nuances that only someone with boat knowledge could bring to the character. I was always finding little things on the ship during the shoot to be like repairing or paying attention to in the wood, and like the space and what it meant to me, Das Malkin explained. Dejected about being refused a spot on the ship, Clemens later saves the grandson Toby from being crushed. The ship's captain, Elliot, is impressed and invites Clemens to join the crew, replacing a new hire who left when he saw a dragon emblem on the crates, letting it fall, nearly crushing Toby. He too is convinced those crates are a bad omen. The shipment, consisting of multiple large wooden crates, is transported by locals from Romania who refuse all help to load it and wish the crew good luck. They say it's cursed, Mr. Elgarin translates for Wojciech. The ship interior was built in Berlin. It was an amazing set and one continuous interior, which really helps build a sense of place. In fact, about 90% of the interiors were one piece. Andre Overdahl would say, that really helps the movie feel like it's actually taking place in a real place. And we needed this vast space to feel like a labyrinth inside, with all the nooks and crannies and dark spots and hallways. Now, that quote is actually a really good setup point for our next scene. With Clemens newly crewed, he is taken on board with Toby, the young Toby, giving him a tour of the ship. Now, this tour serves as a double purpose. It shows Clemens around, but it also gives us as viewers an introduction to all the locations that will come into play as the story develops. On this tour, we meet the ship's cook, Joseph. The chef is incredibly religious, a point that will come into play later on. On 6 July, we finish taking in cargo. Turkish cotton, 10 barrels of petroleum, and private crates marked for London. With 9 hands, crew of 5, 1 ship doctor, 2 mates, cook, and myself, captain. Fair wind, crew in high spirits. Elliot says this will be his last run. He will give the ship to Mr. Wojciech. As you know, characters in movies saying they are doing something for the last time is definitely a sign of bad things to come. And on that topic, we get a little taste of that in one of the crates falling and opening, and the ship's rats scurrying away in fear. While you don't see the vampire yet, you definitely feel his presence in this moment. Now, an interesting bit director Andre Overdahl talked about was how much to show Dracula early on. They wanted to kind of keep his appearances to a minimum in the film. You get ominous looks at his coffin and such, but they wanted to hold on to that initial reveal for a bit. But Overdahl said the marketing and commercials for the movie took that reveal out of their hands. Now, if you remember, the commercials and advertising for this movie all had Dracula front and center for all of it. It's an example, I suppose, of the business side of things taking some of the mystery out of the narrative. Now, there's a terrible racket going on in the ship's animal pens. Clemens and Toby go to check it out. These are animals, chickens, goats, pigs, and such to provide food throughout the voyage. The livestock is going wild. The waters are also getting rough, and they chalk the wildness of the animals to something falling in the cargo hold. It turns out one of the crates had fallen and broken open on the cargo floor. Clemens investigates and finds a woman buried in the dirt inside. Seeing as how she is barely alive, he performs medical acts to keep her alive and does blood transfusion on her to fight against what seems to be an infection. At this point in the film, Clemens really gets to put that big Cambridge brain to work. He brings the young woman up and starts working his medical magic over the protestations of Wojciech as the crew looks on. In taking this role, developing a backstory for his character was incredibly important for Corey Hawkins. He really put a lot of work into making this role believable. In an interview with Collider, Corey Hawkins really delved into how important the research was. Hawkins would say, "It was important in my conversations with the producers and with Andre that whatever we do with Clemens, I think he just needed to make sense, and it just needed to be honest. And so that led to a lot of research, because I've become a bit of a nerd when it comes to my characters. It doesn't matter how off-kilter or whatever it is, I'm a student when I dip into these different worlds and time periods and stuff. So it was important to research these black men who were Cambridge-educated or whatever, sort of higher learning during that time at the turn of the century. That was important to me, to highlight that. If he's going to be a black man, it has to make sense. And so it just was a little bit more digging into that. This role was also important to Hawkins as a black man and the history and education afforded to them in this period," Hawkins explains. "Also, what I found out was that a lot of black American men, mostly, would have gone overseas in order to get that higher education. Now, whether or not they'd be able to practice it, practice their trade or their occupation, was another story. But I think that just informed a lot of his journey, because like he says in the film, his reputation preceded him, but the color of his skin didn't. And so there was information there about him being the other, about evil and the things that he confronted on the day-to-day. So when he confronts this other evil presence named Dracula on this boat, what does that mean? Because Dracula is also the other, and he is the other, and what do they see in each other as well? So I just thought it was fascinating, and just to explore that without hitting the nail on the head or being didactic about it. But it's the reality of it. Like, I'm a black man about to go and do this role, and we have to have it make sense." With the ship now in the Aegean Sea, we are back on deck and see Clemens and Ulgarin interacting a bit. While on patrol, Ulgarin sees a terrifying face in his telescope. It is terrifying, but gone in an instant. Clemens notices Ulgarin disappear and goes to find him. Clemens senses something amiss and proceeds cautiously, where he finds Ulgarin, who tells him he saw someone or something. The following night, all of the animals aboard the ship are killed. Not just killed, mind you, but brutally slaughtered and covered with what seem to be claw and bite marks. This includes the ship's dog, Huck. The crew, thinking Huck did it and fearing a rabies outbreak, throws them all overboard. Petrovsky, another crewman on the ship, believes this to be a result of the bad karma from keeping the stowaway girl on board. "Bad luck, women on board," he explains. Ulgarin, he sees things a little different. He chimes in that no man did this. He senses powerful evil on board. Anna, the secret stowaway that spilled out of the busted box earlier, wakes up and warns Clemens about a local monster in her village named Dracula, whom she was bound to by her village. She claims that Dracula is already on board the ship and is looking to feed. This is another bit where we get the faintest glimpse of the Count, which I love. I am always going to vote to hold on to the big reveal. Now, the hunger of this iteration of Dracula is one movie audiences aren't really used to seeing. This is a more feral and desperate Dracula. Writer Bragi Schuette saw this as a great opportunity to put a new spin on a popular character. Schuette explained to Bloody Flicks, "This version of Dracula, in my mind, always presented some interesting opportunities. Because of the journey and the manner in which Dracula is forced to travel, he is particularly ravenous and emaciated and hungry. He is literally feeding off the crew of the ship during his journey and slowly rebuilding his strength. So as the crew is gradually weakened and picked off and finds themselves in a worse and worse state, Dracula becomes more and more powerful," which was a wonderful and terrible dynamic to explore in the writing. 16th of July. Rough water the last 3 days, and all hands busy with sails. Our ship's doctor continues to administer regular transfusions to our stowaway, yet her condition remains unchanged. Food is running sparse, men downcast, and now past Cape Matapan with more than 2 weeks to travel. In a bit of fact meets fiction, the making of this film brought a weird and unexplained juxtaposition between this and Murnau's Nosferatu. In the Weimar horror, Orlok brought a plague to the city of Weisberg. Here, we have a movie being filmed during a global pandemic and all the issues that come with those circumstances. The stowaway, in a fevered state, repeats one word over and over again in her native Romani tongue. Feed. feed, feed. It's night and Petrovsky is manning the night watch on deck. He hears a noise and calls out, but there is no answer. He walks around and sees a person-sized hole in the lid of the cargo hold. Next, he sees something lying down. A mysterious figure, weak, wheezing, and struggling to move, is in the shadows. Before he can do much, it hops up and rips out the throat of the crewman before feeding on the surly Russian and throwing him overboard. As viewers, we still see very little of the creature. Here, we mostly get shots of his creepy hands as they cover Petrovsky's face as he gasps for life. In another instance of business versus narrative, what murders Petrovsky changed a bit. When he was killed, it was the feral Dracula who tears his throat apart. In earlier incarnations, however, it was a wolf that does the deed. Test screenings told the filmmakers that a lot of folks weren't familiar with the original novel and were unaware that Dracula could take the form of a wolf. People in these test screenings were confused about where the wolf came from, so the change was made and Dracula himself viciously kills Petrovsky instead. Now, Clemens is the one to discover the huge pool of blood and raise an alarm that night. Wojciech seems to think Petrovsky was drunk and fell overboard, or maybe Clemens had something to do with it. As the crew argues, Anna, the stowaway, comes out onto the deck. She keeps saying, he is here," over and over again. She turns frantic and has to be subdued. 18th of July. Men reported in the morning that one of the crew, Petrovsky, was missing. I had the men do a thorough search of the ship. This after Olgarin confided that he had seen something strange nights before. As Clemens tends to the now calmer Anna, we learn her horrifying backstory. She starts off by saying again, he is here, on the ship. It is spoken in my village, she tells him, of an evil that lives in the mountains above. A castle older than any of us. An evil that appears as a man when it wants to hide its true nature. And at night, he feeds on the blood of the innocent. I knew that the elders had made bargains for the safety of our people. We called him Dracula. She goes on to say she was given to Dracula in exchange for her village's safety. She came on board with Dracula in a crate to be his on-crew's meal, if you will, and provide sustenance while stuck on the ship. She shows the doctor her bite marks and wounds. The thing that wears the skin of a man is here, which means they will never leave the ship. This introduction of Anna and her backstory was a necessary deviation from the events in the book and Nosferatu. In those versions, Dracula is just a pure killing machine, feeding to stay alive whilst the crew never knows why or who is doing it. To make a full movie out of such a small bite of a story, a character, like Anna, was needed to provide some exposition and backstory to create the crux of the story going forward. The same goes for Clemens, too. The novel's story never had anyone pushing the action forward, just a crew that mysteriously falls ill or disappears. While cool in the confines of the book's universe, when making a two-hour movie, more through lines are needed, which necessitates some new or expanded characters. It's now night, and a hungry Dracula is on the hunt. Norwegian crewman Larsen is on the rain-covered deck with Olgarin nearby. Dracula attacks Larsen, grabbing his head and slamming it into the deck over and over again. This is an incredibly vicious kill that looks incredibly real. Olgarin comes to his aid, but can do nothing. When Dracula sees him, he chases him up into the rigging. With the two men out of commission, no one is at the wheel, and the ship starts out of control. Once the rest of the crew is up and settling things down, they see the bloody Olgarin in the rigging. They bring him down. He's alive, but wounded. Wounded terribly. Clemens sees his wound is a bite mark on the neck. 24th of July. There seems to be some doom over the ship. Already a hand short entering the Bay of Biscay with wild weather ahead. And last night, a second man lost and another man injured. A strange injury. Men all in a panic of fear. We are 18 days at sea. The closest port is England. We must put our trust in God and go forward. Olgarin is struggling to live. He is writhing and moving as if in the throes of a fever. The rest of the crew knows something is wrong with him and ties him to a table. Captain Elliot increases the watches and expands what little manpower he has so no man is alone, and makes everyone on the watch be armed. The crew also fully searches every inch of the ship. Captain Elliot takes Toby into his quarters and gives him the job of watching his spyglass. He wants to keep young Toby's mind off the terrible events going on. When he leaves, he locks the door behind him. Olgarin, in an apparent connection to the Count, breaks free of his tethers. Toby hears something and leaves the room and sees his friend Olgarin. But it's not the Olgarin he knew before. This is a scary, zombie-like Olgarin who wants to kill Toby. Toby runs for his life back to the safety of the captain's quarters. He makes it in and believes he is safe, but unbeknownst to Toby, something entered the room when he was away. Olgarin is slamming his head into and through the door in an effort to get to Toby. On the deck, the crew hears the commotion. They head down and are able to subdue the bloody Olgarin before he can get in. Unfortunately, Dracula sits in the shadows stalking Toby before attacking as Elliot and Clemens look on, unable to reach the boy. This scene was really super terrifying on a number of levels, but Javier Botet's work as Dracula is one of the biggest parts of it. One of the most amazing things about this film is the makeup and practical Dracula effects, since we're talking about Dracula. The work done to make this iteration of Dracula is truly terrifying. Clark Collis of Entertainment Weekly takes us a bit deeper. He writes, "The director's vision, turned into reality by prosthetic makeup designer Jorn Seifert, meant long hours in the makeup chair for Botet, but the actor believes the results were worth the effort. It's been one of the best makeups for sure I've had," he says. "Jorn and his team made amazing designs. We had 3-4 different looks. In the beginning, it was a more skinny, more white, more weak, and then it started getting bigger. And after we release the movie, we will show a lot of photos of the procedure, and it will blow the mind of a lot of makeup lovers." In a throwback to Anna's earliest appearances, Clemens has Elliot provide blood transfusions to his grandson in an effort to save the boy's life. "August 1st. We must be past the Strait of Dover. Still 5 days to London. God seems to have deserted us, and we are drifting to some terrible doom. Lord, help us." The next morning, Olgarin was tied to the mast by the crew. He talks and mutters very cryptic things, mostly about how he can hear the blood pumping in everyone's veins. You know, weird vampiric things. While he's tied up, though, the sun starts to rise. As the sun's rays wash over him, Olgarin bursts into flames. Wojciech grabs a rifle and puts Olgarin down. Everyone is in disbelief. In an effort to get to the bottom of the mystery, Clemens and Anna go through the ship's manifest and paperwork. They find the consignment paperwork for the 50 crates of earth marked as private cargo and find out it's headed to Carfax Abbey in London, but with no owner's name attached. After that, they start popping open the crates. They eventually open the one Dracula was in, but he's not in it now. Just a wolf's head cane. So, at least they were able to get some wolf representation into the movie. As the search continues, the religious chef Joseph takes a lifeboat out and gets himself off the ship. He is rowing away as he quotes scripture, hoping to escape the evil he believes has befallen them for their sins. Unfortunately, his piety won't save him here. Even though he couldn't be a wolf earlier, Dracula gets his bat transformation on and flies to the lifeboat, where he brutally kills Joseph. When the crew finally realizes the boat is missing, it floats back and crashes into the Demeter. No Joseph, but there's tons of blood and a Bible in the boat. Despite blood transfusions from his grandfather, Toby gets no better. It is safe to say, whatever happened to Olgarin will soon come for the boy. His smaller frame actually speeds up the sickness. And it is all for naught as Toby dies and is wrapped in a sailcloth for his burial at sea. It's a very emotional scene with Anna saying a few words. At this point, Captain Elliot has lost all hope and resigns himself to the fact that they are all headed to hell. They are truly a doomed ship with a doomed crew. The death of Toby really sets the tone that this cruise ain't ending well for anybody. I mean, going into it, knowing the book and several cinematic treatments, you know how the story ends. But when you see a kid die, especially in such a gruesome way, you realize this film isn't pulling any punches. a kid and a dog are mercilessly killed. This is no pleasure cruise for sure. Now, during the funeral, the captain believes he sees his grandson's body moving and unwraps it, only to see Toby open his eyes and attack him. The now vampiric Toby catches fire in the sunlight, also severely burning his grandfather before the crew is able to throw Toby into the ocean. Like I mentioned a moment ago, this is a completely new iteration of Dracula. In an interview with Entertainment Weekly, director Andre Overdahl digs into the inspiration of this ship-bound bloodsucker. One side is the old, fragile man, who's over 400 years old, who is now suffering from a lack of blood, and he's become almost like an addict, Overdahl says. When he regains his powers through killing the crew one by one, he then becomes the demon. For that version of Dracula, we are going for references in animals, and especially, of course, bats, to portray muscle movements and how they used their wings. The remaining crew members decide to attempt to scuttle the ship and, in turn, drown Dracula to prevent him from wreaking havoc on London. Wojciech is against it at first, but Clemens talks about his life and relates back to their current situation, which finally wins Wojciech's respect. If anyone will sink the Demeter, Wojciech says, it will be him. Now, earlier I had talked about how important practical effects were to the filmmakers, but I would be remiss if I didn't speak a bit about the CGI in this movie. Long story short, it is amazing. Listening to the audio commentary, there were so many pieces of CGI that I just figured were real life, from the port city during the early loading sequence to waves beside the ship, and in even some cases, the ship itself. The special effects gang really did some really great work on this picture. To that point, Overdahl said there were over 1,200 visual effects shots in the film, which actually surprised me. Back to the film action, the gang takes their positions to wait for nightfall and hunt the beast. Elliot is in his quarters writing in his captain's log so people will know their story. He is shocked to hear Clemens say that they plan to abandon ship. At this point, Elliot is really out there. The death of his grandson has really driven him over the edge. Anna is able to walk the captain back a little and gain his help with their plan to do it in honor of Toby. With the shores of England in sight and a storm on its way, it is time to begin the attack on the beast. Anna is used to lure the count out, with Abrams and Wojciech high up with guns drawn. Things go bad quickly, with Abrams killed first and tossed from the crow's nest. One of the biggest differences between Nosferatu and Demeter comes in the death of Captain Elliot. Famously, in the book and Nosferatu, the captain of the ship is found tied to the wheel. Here in Demeter, Clemens finds Captain Elliot tied to the wheel by the hands and the waist. Clemens unties his hands and the two share a moment, with Elliot telling Clemens to tell the world of their sacrifice. While Elliot is still tied to the wheel, it's not the iconic look of him attached to the wheel we get in the other iterations, but he is still tied to the wheel nonetheless. Wojciech is the next to be attacked by Dracula. He eventually fights Dracula into the cargo hold of the ship. He is injured, but grabs an axe and starts trying to chop a hole in the ship. He does all he can before Dracula eventually gets to him and kills him. Clemens tries to save the first mate, but is too late. By the time Clemens gets back to the captain, Dracula had already bit him and he is dead. As the rain pours down harder and harder, then the ship rocks back and forth, waves crashing all the while, an emotional Clemens calls out to the beast in the darkness. He yells, "You want them to believe you're a god. You and I know, both know you're not. You bleed like any of us. You sleep in dirt. You feed. Above all else, you feed. You want us to fear you. Underneath, you're afraid. You're afraid of what lies on the other side, as any other living being." This last stand against Dracula is one that really stands out to Corey Hawkins. The entire final battle sequence, I think, is probably one of my favorites I've ever done in a film, he explains. Getting knocked over and knocked down and water dumped on you over and over and over. You know, the water's freezing. Water's like literally in your boots. Now, all this action leads to a super cool standoff between Clemens and Dracula. The monster flies down and attacks the doctor. As he is about to bite Clemens, Anna shoots Dracula. Though she was able to slow down Dracula and save Clemens, Anna does not leave unscathed. In fact, she is bitten by Dracula during this attempt to save Clemens. But Clemens returns the favor and rescues Anna by striking Dracula with an axe, and Anna manages to crush Dracula with part of the ship's mast. Anna and Clemens jump ship, thinking Dracula is doomed as this ship begins to sink. Dracula is able to push the mast off his body and screams in pain and rage. As we have learned, if there's nothing we've learned from horror movies and Dracula movies, Dracula always finds a way. As we start to wrap this up, let's take a quick look at where this film was shot. The Last Voyage of the Demeter was filmed in Malta and Germany, more specifically Berlin in Germany, and the Medina and Malta Film Studios in Malta. Filming ran from June 30th, 2021 to October 1st, 2021. Now, one of the most amazing things about where this was filmed was that the Malta studio had a monstrous infinity tank that looks out onto the Mediterranean, built specifically for productions to film ocean-based stuff in. The featurette on this location filming was really a sight to behold, and you can see it added so much to the production value of the movie itself. The film's production designer, Edward Thomas, and his team set about to construct a wooden ship for use in the film. This construction project resulted in the largest wooden ship ever built at this studio. The ship was approximately 180 feet long, which is the size of the ship in the novel. That lets you know that A, they were very aware and very attempting to stay close to the source material, but also lets you know, building a 180-foot schooner, this is a pretty big production. But now you've built a schooner, how do you make that schooner move? Thomas explains, it's got a massive barge underneath it, which is full of air tanks, which, when we fill them with water and air at the same time, make the ship list from port to starboard to get it as close to the real thing as possible. With a budget of $45 million and more than 1,000 cast and crew members involved, this was no small feat. Malta actually has been a very popular filming location recently, seeing over 200 international productions come to town. The Last Voyage of the Demeter was definitely the largest. Due to its production scale, the film injected nearly $18 million into the Maltese economy. Now, going back to film action, Anna and Clemens float away on debris and wreckage from the ship. Anna reveals to Clemens that she is turning into a vampire as a result of her infection, with Clemens' blood transfusions only delaying her transformation. As morning approaches, not wanting to become a monster like Dracula, Anna willingly gives herself to the sun. Clemens knows she is changing and wants to try and help somehow. Another transfusion would only delay the inevitable. He can't watch her die, but she refuses any help. My whole life, she tells him, my people, the devil, they chose for me. I choose this, no one else. The two hold hands one last time. She climbs up on a piece of debris and floats off as the sun rises, and she burns to death before Clemens drifts ashore. A little time has passed, and Clemens, clean and healthy, is in a London bar in the evening asking for directions to Carfax Abbey. The barkeeper tells him it's a couple hours by carriage to reach, and he should wait till daylight before going. He tells her he was thinking the same thing. While in the bar, Clemens sees Dracula disguised as an aristocratic human only to vanish. And so, I will pursue this foul beast, and I swear by those who have given their lives that I will extinguish this blight and send it back to hell. And that, folks, is how we end this bloody two-hour boat tour. In an interview with Entertainment Weekly's Kurt Cullis, Javier Botet was very happy to have donned the infamous fangs for this awesome film. Cullis writes, Botet himself is delighted to have gotten his chance at portraying Stoker's vampire and says that he would happily reprise the role no matter how much discomfort that involved. In the last years, everyone asked me what monsters I want to do. I always say Dracula, Nosferatu, he says. Yes, I would love to play Dracula again, in a sequel, or even another franchise or another studio. Dracula never dies, never stops, he's immortal. To the horror crowd, so is Botet. As great as Botet and the production overall was, it didn't really seem to translate to the financial aspects of things. As of September 2nd, 2023, The Last Voyage of the Demeter had grossed $13.6 million in the United States and Canada, and $6.3 million in other territories, for a worldwide total of $19.9 million. In the United States and Canada, The Last Voyage of the Demeter was projected to gross $6 to $11 million from 2,715 theaters. The film made $2.6 million on its first day, including $750,000 from Thursday night previews. It went on to debut to $6.5 million, finishing fifth at the box office. The film dropped 62% in its second week to $2.5 million, falling to 10th. While the movie didn't do particularly well at the box office, the reviews and feelings towards the film were pretty split. This film is a great example of a movie where critics are opposite moviegoer sentiment. According to review aggregator site Rotten Tomatoes, critics thought it was rotten, while crowds thought it was actually really fresh. And the two scores really weren't that close. I definitely fell on the side of loving this movie. As a Dracula and vampire nut, I loved the concept going in. This was everything you want in a horror movie. At a base level, this film gives you all the good stuff you go to a horror movie for. The fun jump scares, the gory and brutal kills, enough mystery to keep you in suspense. It's all there. Even knowing how the story ends, this movie managed to keep me on the edge of my seat. And that is a feat in and of itself. Even when you know the ending, it still manages to surprise and fill viewers with anxiety and horror. In fact, I think knowing how the story goes helps heighten the drama. You know how, just not when and what form it will take. The performances are fantastic. Sure, some of the characters get the short stick on background and full characterizations, but the main folks in the movie I thought gave tremendous performances and really brought their characters to life. Corey Hawkins was an actor I was not familiar with, but now I look forward to catching up on his back catalog. Another thing that really stood out was the boat itself. The Demeter was its own character. The fact they built an entire boat for this movie was a stroke of genius. Films on sound stages and such can really come off as goofy when trying to portray a believable ship environment. Having access to an entire ship really adds to the believability and immersion of this movie. Another great aspect of this film is the music. The Last Voyage of the Demeter brought some awesome music from the talented Bear McCreary. McCreary has done music for a ton of high-profile projects, like the video game God of War Ragnarok, The Rings of Power, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and television shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Outlander. And that's just a little bit of his resume. Director Andre Overdahl takes us deeper into the work of Bear McCreary. Overdahl breaks it down like this, saying, "Bear McCreary made some fantastic music. He created a really grand, epic piece of music for this movie, which feels like it's this journey from one side of Europe to the other." The work McCreary did on this was fantastic and really added to an already lingering sense of doom. It felt like its own character as well. He is incredibly talented and definitely brought the goods. Horror films can be made or broken with their musical scores. Having subpar music can really detract from the proceedings, but that's not the case here. Not even close. So, cheers to you, Mr. McCreary. Like I mentioned earlier, opinions about this movie seem to be all over the place. According to Patrice Witherspoon from Screen Rant, The Last Voyage of the Demeter fails to deliver on its early promise of being a compelling horror experience. The focus on jump scares and a skeptic character detracts from the potential scares and fails to bring authenticity to the storytelling. She continues, "The film lacks originality and doesn't distinguish itself from previous vampire stories. It sacrifices epic sequences of carnage for a slow-paced flick that feels more focused on setting up a potential sequel than delivering a satisfying standalone film." In his review for The Nerdist, Kyle Anderson writes, "It's not like the movie is bad necessarily. It's a supremely competent horror thriller that's definitely in the vein of studio monster movies that came before. Certain shots and moments are very effective. The decision to make Dracula more monster than man is a fun riff, and the setting certainly sets it apart. But it's also just loads of plot without much story, characteristics rather than characters, and in a pace better suited to action than horror. But without much action either. They make for a pleasant enough 2 hours without ever engaging much." Not all critics were unimpressed, though. David Fear of Rolling Stone reviewed the film thusly. He said, "But this is also the type of project that manages to lift itself above the fray by sheer will and chops, not to mention its determination to scratch a throwback genre itch. The Last Voyage of the Demeter is a threadbare, high-concept story given the high thread count treatment. A lovely piece of luxury pulp. It's also the creepiest and classiest bit of late summer counter-programming you're likely to find, which may say more about our current landscape of cinematic pleasures than the movie itself. The Observer's Rex Reed also left with some positivity in his heart. He wrote, "Under the guidance of André Øvredal, the Norwegian director of the cult films Troll Hunter and Autopsy of Jane Doe, they all excel in complex and physically demanding roles, including Corey Hawkins as Clemens, Aisling Franciosi as Anna, and Liam Cunningham as the captain. Special effects are excellent, and the clammy cinematography by Tom Stern is enough to give you nightmares. Filmed in Malta, a rare film location I'd like to see more of." And before we go, for our bite of Pittsburgh for this episode, Sean Collier of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette adds, "If the strokes of character development are broad, it's forgivable shorthand en route to the desperate survival horror that ensues. The attacks start slowly, then escalate rapidly once the ship is beyond quick reach of any port. The turn from something may be wrong here to none of us may reach England alive is swift and brutal. Undoubtedly," Collier continues, "it's a dark and desperate tale. Unlike many vampire films, there's no whimsy and certainly no romance here. Instead, there's a lovely, sad sense of adventure as the beautiful sunsets and swashbuckling setting is flipped into a house of horrors." So with this episode crashed up against the rocks, we want to thank you for taking this little bonus boat trip with us. It was a wild ride full of bonus blood and gore on the high seas and actors that talk. Scary, isn't it? If you're a silent film fanatic that gave this episode a chance, thank you. If you're a modern movie fan that gave this episode a chance, we want to thank you too. And hopefully you'll stick around for great silent film explorations with us. Did you enjoy the vampiric violence as much as we did? What were your favorite moments from this modern-day period horror film? What kills in this flick especially impressed you? How did you feel about us taking a quick detour into the land of the talkies? Let us know all that and more at the various social media hangouts of the Golden Silent Films podcast. On that note, if you have forgotten, we are always haunting Instagram and Twitter or X. Let us know what you think of this episode. What silent-related movies, past or present, do you want us to dip into next? Our world of silent movie knowledge and experience is constantly growing, and we need your input to guide our future episodes here in Season 3 and beyond. And you can always bite into the Golden Silence cast on Instagram and at Golden Silence 1 on Twitter. And again, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast outlet that allows it, subscribe, rate, and your review. I reckon it'll help a lot here, and we love hearing your thoughts and ideas. We really, really appreciate all of your incredible support, and seeing how much you folks are listening only makes us want to make bigger and better episodes. So, with all that being said, thank you to all of you fine listeners for all of your fine listening. And don't forget, the silence are golden, and the talkies, they're just a fad. Except for the one we talked about today. My hope is that it is essentially the scariest Dracula movie ever made. That's where I would love it to land if possible. If somebody says that, I'd be very happy, says Last Voyage of the Demeter director André Øvredal.